From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, want the GOP nomination? Well, ditch retail politics and start using Moneyball politics. Also, Newt Gingrich has been calling Mitt Romney the weakest frontrunner since Leonard Wood. Who?
This has probably been the best week for Leonard Wood in about the last 80 years.
Plus, foxes that fetch and roll over in Siberia, and the unlikely journey of Red Bull from rural Thailand to the clubs of Europe.
Red Bull gives you wings!
Also, a three-minute fiction superstar who can't enter, the story behind a lost passport found 60 years later, and also two music interviews with two hit bands. First, Nate Roos from the band Fun. Tonight. And then, the man behind the band The Shins, James Mercer.
Well, I guess it's only life, it's only natural.
That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. 1144. That's the magic number needed to secure the GOP presidential nomination. 1,144 delegates. Mitt Romney has a little less than half that number right now, but he's still way ahead of his closest rival, Rick Santorum. Santorum's a threat, though, so the two candidates seem to be sharpening their math skills, because in the end, it's math that will likely win the race. And in many Republican primaries and caucuses, from Missouri, which began yesterday, to Puerto Rico today, to Illinois on Tuesday, in most of them, the winner doesn't clean up. The delegates are awarded proportionally. It's a new system for Republicans this time around, and it's led to what could be called Moneyball politics. And that's our cover story today. Now, all of this is very familiar to former Democratic strategist Jeff Berman. During the 2008 presidential primary, Berman was the mastermind behind Barack Obama's delegate strategy. He wrote about it in his new book, The Magic Number. You were like one of the foremost experts on the arcane Byzantine rules of the Democratic Party.
Well, there is a certain truth to that, indeed. Yes, I am.
Jeff Berman was Obama's secret weapon. And when it comes to the way political parties nominate candidates, well, he changed the game.
I joined the campaign in the spring of 2007, which would be about a year earlier than where we are today in this cycle, and spent several months looking at all of the states, all of the congressional districts, the order of the primaries, the possibility that one outcome would affect another, and what the allocation of delegates would be, whether we won or we lost. I called and spoke with experts throughout the country. We would look at demographics, voting histories, cultural attributes to try and figure out how that district would vote. And then I could target those districts and those states where I thought we were close to either winning more delegates or losing a delegate, and built that together into a master strategy.
Now, it is hard to emphasize how new this model was in presidential politics. Before 2008, conventional wisdom was you campaigned long and hard in the big delegate states, places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida. You lock those up, you win the nomination. You didn't waste your time running grassroots operations in places like
Louisiana, Nebraska, Washington State, and the Virgin Islands.
But those were the places that in early February of 2008, using Jeff Berman's strategy,
Obama swept them all.
Meaning it's a clean sweep for the Illinois senator who has beaten Hillary Clinton in all four of this weekend's Democratic contests.
Then the next day on Sunday was Maine.
The race in Maine was considered a toss-up as recently as this morning, but Brett Baer, Barack Obama has prevailed.
On the following Tuesday, we had Virginia.
Barack Obama is the winner of the Virginia Democratic primary.
Maryland.
Projecting a victory for Barack Obama in Maryland by a significant margin.
Washington, D.C.
89% of the vote in Washington, D.C.
And on the following Tuesday,
the Hawaii caucuses.
So you got 10 in a row for Senator Barack Obama.
CNN can now project that Senator Barack Obama has enough delegates to secure the Democratic presidential nomination.
You were basically playing a version of Moneyball.
Well, I mean, you can put it that way. You can call it chess. You can call it whatever you wish. But in running that table for that two-week period, that's when we built a delegate lead of about 150 delegates, and it never got any bigger. From that point on, my mission was hold that lead.
That's Jeff Berman's legacy. Primaries are now a lot about math. And that's why Jeff Berman believes when it comes to the Republican race, well, it's still very much up for grabs. even with Romney's delegate lead.
Yeah, he is still ahead in the delegate count. And for Rick Santorum, who is his leading challenger, the challenge for him is to maintain his political momentum, which he now has, having won Alabama and Mississippi. And that
and Illinois, of course.
Yeah, and then Illinois, followed by Louisiana. He has the potential for a very strong run of wins. And success can bring some delegate rewards down the line. And this time, the race is not strictly proportional in terms of the delegate allocations.
Right.
That's the way it was for us.
For Democrats.
For Democrats, it was in 08.
Yeah.
This time, there are multiple opportunities for Rick Santorum to do far better than a proportional outcome, but it requires strength going forward.
How soon do you think the GOP nominee, the presumed eventual nominee, could reach the point of getting more than half of the delegates they need, if all goes according to plan?
Yeah, I think it would be unlikely for any of the candidates, including Mitt Romney, to reach that number prior to the end of the primaries, which is in June.
This is going to go for a while.
I think so, yes.
Do you think that, or do you have any intel on whether any of the Republican campaigns are reading your book?
I don't know what the Republican campaigns are doing. I didn't know what Hillary was doing, so I don't know what the Republicans are doing.
Could it serve as a template for them? I mean, if they were trying to figure out, you know, how to pull this off?
I think they might find it helpful, yes.
Jeff Berman, his new book about the 2008 presidential primary is called The Magic Number. Now, one person we haven't mentioned yet is Newt Gingrich. The former House Speaker trails both Romney and Santorum in the delegate race. He's under a lot of pressure to bow out. But Jonathan Chait, political writer for New York Magazine, says from Gingrich's perspective, it may make more sense to go the distance and become the kingmaker at the convention.
Gingrich is dividing the conservative alternative to Romney vote. He's prevented Romney from having to face a united conservative front. So Gingrich's continued campaigning is helping Romney win these plurality victories and continue to maintain his status as frontrunner without making it over 50% in many states at all.
What do you think Gingrich gets out of staying in right now?
If I was Newt Gingrich and trying to be rational, and that's a huge assumption when you're talking about Newt Gingrich, I'd be thinking that what I have of value to offer is to Mitt Romney. Romney wants me in the race, so I would have some kind of back channel discussion with Mitt Romney and say, what can I do for you? What can you do for me? Newt Gingrich, when this is over, is going to go back to his influence peddling business on K Street. A lot of Mitt Romney's friends could help him.
So your theory is that Gingrich continues to take votes away from Santorum. He goes all the way to Tampa, and then he delivers his delegates to Mitt Romney, hoping maybe to be rewarded if Romney becomes president.
That's what I would do if I was Newt Gingrich, but, you know, you never know with Newt Gingrich.
Many Republicans are saying that 2012 is a tipping point, you know, that this election can change America's course.
Right.
And it's nothing new. We hear that every 4 years. But this time around, you've been arguing that they have a point. How so?
What I argued in my New York Magazine piece is that these constant invocations of now or never and tipping point actually mean something more than the typical election rhetoric. And Republicans have perceived that the election of Obama heralded this rising demographic coalition that's going to slowly make electoral conditions worse for them, that they have a short-term opportunity to expand on the gains they made largely due to the recession and to get a sort of big bang win in 2012, and that compromises are going to be required in the future, but they don't want to have to make them. So this fear that they've expressed, I think, really is based on something real, that the country is getting more non-white, that their non-college-educated white base is shrinking steadily as a percentage of the electorate, and things are going to get worse for Republican conservatism as we know it today, and their days are, in some sense, numbered.
That's political writer Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine. One final note here about Newt Gingrich and presidential history. Lately, the former speaker has been calling Mitt Romney the weakest frontrunner in modern times. He did so on this program a few weeks ago.
He is the weakest frontrunner in modern times, despite outspending the rest of us by more than 3-1.
And last week on CNN, he clarified that.
The fact is, Romney's probably the weakest Republican frontrunner since Leonard Wood in 1920.
So Newt Gingrich raises a very, very important question, and that is, who is Leonard Wood?
Good question. This has probably been the best week for Leonard Wood in about the last 80 years.
That's presidential historian Michael Beschloss.
Leonard Wood was a general, very close friend of Theodore Roosevelt. They did the Rough Riders together. They were in the Battle of San Juan Hill in Cuba. He was also a doctor. Wood was running for president before the 1920 Republican convention and was thought to be a shoo-in.
Was Leonard Wood among the weakest frontrunners in American history?
He was in this sense, because a lot of people thought he was going to be nominated. There were four ballots. He reached his peak and flamed out. He finally lost the nomination to Warren Harding, the senator from Ohio, one of the worst presidents in American history. So what Newt Gingrich is essentially saying is,
I'm Warren Harding.
I'm going to be Harding. I think he would consider it slander if it was said by someone else.
Michael, we actually unearthed a recording of Leonard Wood giving a speech. This is on Americanism. That's the theme of the speech. Let's listen to it. This is from 1920.
Americanization must be taken up earnestly and systematically. America first must be stamped on every heart.
Okay, a little bit difficult to understand, but he's talking about Americanization, that everybody needs to speak the language of the Declaration of Independence. Nobody should be waving the red flag, which is a major threat to American democracy. What kind of candidate was he?
Not a great one. If you hear that voice, even in 1920, that's not exactly a barn-burning speech or huge personality.
With equality of privilege and opportunity goes equality of obligation. In war and in peace.
But he had been in Cuba, he had been in the Philippines, and one of the things he felt very strongly was those places should be Americanized. There were a lot of people who felt the same way in 1920.
What happens to Leonard Wood?
Well, Harding owed him a lot, because if Wood had not been such a bad candidate, Harding would not have been president.
Yeah.
The result was Wood got what he really wanted, which was to be Governor General of the Philippines. He died in 1927, but ultimately got a terrific military fort, which still exists in Missouri.
Yeah, Fort Leonard Wood.
Indeed.
Do you think the Romney-Wood comparison is apt?
It's apt in this respect. If Mitt Romney makes it to Tampa and he has not got a locked-in majority of those delegates, he could actually compete with Leonard Wood for being the weakest front-runner. And if that happens, a good chance that Romney will not be nominated, and there could be a dark horse like Warren Harding or someone a lot better who ends up getting that nomination.
That's presidential historian Michael Beschloss. Michael, thanks.
My pleasure, Guy.
From an unseasonably warm winter to a place where winter never seems to end, Siberia. And it was there, outside a small town in 1954, where a Russian geneticist named Dmitry Belaev set out to isolate the genes that make dogs so easy to train. Well, most dogs. Anyway, Belaev decided he'd work with wild foxes. He wanted to compress 50,000 years of evolution into a few decades. Basically, breed foxes to fetch and roll over and cuddle up at the foot of your bed. Belaev died in the mid-1980s, but the project continues at that same fox farm in Siberia. Caredwin Terrell, a researcher and professor at Concordia University in Portland, recently visited the fox farm and told us all about it.
It looks like a rundown army barracks.
In the middle of Siberia.
Yes. It's outside of a town called Akadem Gorodok, which means academic town. It's the scientific center of Siberia. And the farm itself is quite dilapidated. So what you have are rows and rows of sheds that house about 100 foxes each in 3x3 wire cubes.
100 foxes in those small confined spaces.
That's right. There's about 3,000 foxes on site.
We have some audio from your time there. You can actually hear the foxes. Let's listen to this for a moment. Mm-hmm.
A little bit. Yeah. This one more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you see the video, they're literally pressing up against the fence. They want to lick you. You're kind of petting them. The cage opens up, and there's a fox that just lies on its back, and you're scratching its belly like a dog. This is a fox.
It's a fox, and it really is desirous of human contact.
Huh.
They're genetically designed to crave human contact. So that fox loved having its belly scratched.
54 years on, how close are they to domesticating and taming wild foxes?
So close. It's the last step.
Huh.
The last step. We are at a genetically tame population right now. What would be required at this point to see if they are truly a domestic population of foxes is to take fox kits as pups and begin socializing them to people, and then beginning a training program of the like that we would put dogs through.
I mean, could they do any of these foxes seem to be willing to fetch or to sit on command or do anything like that?
There have been individual foxes, yes, who have demonstrated the ability to sit and the ability to fetch. The thing with domestication is we can't just rely on a handful of individual cases. It's really important that we see it on a large scale. It has to be in a systematic way.
Professor Terrell, some people listening to this, some people, they're going to say, I want a pet fox. Where can I get one?
Personally, I hope that this doesn't become another pet industry, because for the reason that we have so many companion animals in desperate need of homes. I mean, in the United States alone, 6 to 8 million cats and dogs enter our shelters every single year. So you can buy a pet fox.
This fox farm has actually sold some foxes,
yes,
right?
Yes, because the experiment is broke. And so one of the ways to try to recoup some costs has been to sell a few of the foxes into the exotic pet trade. And there is a company in the United States that acts as a private distributor. You know, they promise for just under $7,000 that you can get a fox on your front door that's 4 months old. Well, at 4 months old, the fox's socialization window has closed. So those adult foxes, they arrive on the doorstep and, you know, it's advised that they're kept in a cage. So they haven't been socialized to life in a human household in the way that a dog has, for example.
Has this project in any way shed any light on how dogs became domestic? I mean, do we have a better sense of how that happened based on the experiment that the Russian scientists have done with foxes?
The experiment demonstrated that these foxes are indeed genetically tame. Now, what we don't know is if these foxes are truly domestic, and we won't know if that's possible unless foxes and humans are living together.
That's Professor Caradwyn Terrell. She's the author of a book called Part Wild, One Woman's Journey with a Creature Caught Between the Worlds of Wolves and Dogs, speaking about her recent visit to a fox farm in Siberia. Professor Terrell, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you.
Some sad news from the beverage world today. The creator of the energy drink Red Bull Chaleo Uvidia has died at the age of 89. He actually invented what would become Red Bull in the 1970s. Originally, it was marketed to truck drivers and blue-collar workers in Thailand. But in 1982, an Austrian businessman was about to make future generations of teenagers, clubbers, and extreme sports aficionados very amped up. Dietrich Mateschitz tried the Thai energy drink known then as Kratin Dang, and he loved it. In fact, he discovered that the drink cured his jet lag, so Mateschitz tracked down Chaleo Uvidia, and the rest is history. By 1992, Red Bull started to go global with creative ads like this one.
I say, Leonardo, how's that painting color?
It's a masterpiece, way ahead of its time.
We asked for something that would uplift the human spirit. What on earth is that?
Exactly, this is it. I am a genius. It's a drink called Red Bull.
Red Bull? You call that a work of art? You must be mad.
You'll see. Someday everybody will be singing, Red Bull gives you it.
That's it. I'm giving the chapel dub to Michelangelo.
The drink made Dietrich Mateschitz and Chaleo Uvidia very, very rich. Uvidia was born the son of poor Chinese immigrants. His parents raised ducks to make a living. Red Bull made him a multi-billionaire, Thailand's third richest man and the 205th richest in the world. Red Bull sells 4 billion cans of its energy drink a year in more than 160 countries. Here's one of them. To Red Bull co-founder Chaleo Uvidia.
I gotta drink up and be somebody. I have another round. I can't let my troubles find me.
Round 8 of 3-Minute Fiction is underway. You can enter the contest and find out all about it by going to our website, npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. 3-Minute Fiction is all spelled out. No spaces. We've already received 1,000 stories. And this past week, we got a letter in our inbox from Kahlo Smith. And this is what she wrote.
I am 11 years old. I wanted to enter Round 8 of the 3-Minute Fiction contest. I have a story that fits all the guidelines. It's less than 600 words and begins with the sentence, "She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk out the door." But when I checked the entry rules, it said that the contest was open to people 18 or older. Is there a reason for this?
Well, it turns out there is a reason for this, and we've called NPR's general counsel, our top lawyer, Joyce Slocum, to come here to the studio to explain why. Joyce, why can't Kahlo enter this competition?
The shorthand is that minor children do not have the capacity to enter into contracts.
Huh.
A child who enters into a contract may have the ability to have it voided by a court even after they become an adult.
And entering three-minute fiction is entering a contract?
Yes.
Really?
A contract is offer and acceptance and consideration.
Now,
and
NPR doesn't make these rules, right? This is the government.
Well, we make the sweepstakes rules.
Right.
The states make the rules about what minor children can and can't do.
So why do we have to say 18 or over?
Because once they enter the contest, we can take their copyrighted work and use it for our own purposes.
Okay, but if I, like, buy a box of Fruity Pebbles, and I'm not 18, and I can enter their sweepstakes.
Usually all they have is you send in your name, and then they draw a winner.
Yeah.
They're not asking anything from you in return. And you think about it, you know, when we get these three-minute fiction stories in, they don't just appear briefly on the radio program and then disappear. We want to keep these available to people for a very long time.
Could we put three-minute fiction on a box of Fruity Pebbles?
Well, if you didn't want an agreement to continue to use copyrighted work, you could.
Okay, so bottom line, Kahlo is out of luck. She cannot enter this competition.
Sorry.
Joyce, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Break my heart.
It breaks my own heart.
All right. Well, now that our lawyer has left the room, Kahlo, are you there? Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
We got Kahlo Smith on the line because we received your story, and it was so good that we just couldn't bear the thought of shutting you out. And it turns out you cannot enter this competition. You heard what Joyce said. What are your thoughts? Do you understand?
Well, I understand that it's a legal thing that minors cannot enter the competition, but it seems unfair.
How long did it take you to write the story?
Actually, I'm not understanding what everyone finds so great about this. For me, it's a story that I wrote in half an hour.
Half an hour? Actually, that proves that three-minute fiction can be done by anybody. How did you hear about the contest?
My mom was listening to NPR, and she heard about the contest, and she knows that I like writing, so she told me I should enter.
Are you a pretty regular NPR listener?
Well, my parents are, so I end up listening to it a lot.
Do you like it? Do you enjoy listening to NPR?
Well, sometimes it can be a bit boring. I am not an adult, so I do not usually listen to radio stuff that involves so much talking. I'm like, where's the music station on this thing? But usually I like it.
And do you write a lot of short stories?
Well, the one that my dad and mom probably remember best is when I was little, I wrote a story about a turtle who gets sent to, like, this shelter for sea animals because it got caught in a plastic bag and then is released at the end of the story. But other than that, they're mostly school assignments, which I do, though, write by myself.
Well, Kahlo, I am sorry that you cannot officially enter. I think it's unfair, but, you know, that's the rules. The rules are the rules are the rules. But here's what we're going to do. We called Luis Alberto Urrea, our judge, this round. He's going to send you a signed copy of his book, and we're also going to send you some NPR stuff, and we're going to post your story online as well. So not so bad, right?
Yeah, I was actually thinking that even if I did enter the contest, it'd probably be like, I get one of those automatic reply emails, your story has been read by the judges, though you did not win, and thank you for entering the contest.
Well, Kahlo may not be able to enter officially, but if you are over 18, you still can. You've got until the 25th of March at Sunday at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. Go to our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. 3-minute fiction is all spelled out. Every story has to be 600 words or less. It has to begin with the exact sentence. She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. Kahlo Smith joined us from member station KUSP in Santa Cruz. Kahlo, I'm sorry that you couldn't officially enter, but, you know, hey, this isn't so bad, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like I won. I still get the stuff. My story still gets read. I'm pretty happy.
Thanks for being a good sport.
Thank you.
And without further ado, here is an excerpt from Kahlo's story, Night Bus, as read by NPR's Susan Stamberg.
It was chilly outside, and she hugged her thin turtleneck sweater closer to her. She glanced up. The first stars were appearing, dotting the night sky with pinpricks of light, like holes in the black blanket draped over some chairs that had served as her magical fort as a child. She pushed her glasses up, looked around, and started down the street. She looked young, too young to be walking the streets at night. No more than 16, a passerby might have thought, had they paid attention to this young girl walking down the sidewalk alone, arms crossed tightly across her torso, head down. Cars whizzed by, dark, fast-moving shapes stirring up her long brown hair. She breathed in the winter air, cold and clear in her lungs. She glanced in the window of a coffee shop as she passed it, the warm, bright place contrasting sharply with the cold and dark that surrounded her.
To another drama now, certainly a story Nora Ephron might want to hear, because this one could easily be made into a Nora Ephron film. It came to us by way of an article in the UC Berkeley newsletter. There are two parallel stories, actually, one that begins in 1949, the other in 2011, and yes, those stories eventually intersect. Let's start in 1949.
My name is Betty Werther. I'm originally from the U.S., from Westchester County in New York, and I've been living in Paris for over 60 years.
In 1949, Betty graduated from UC Berkeley, and her grandmother wanted to buy her a gift.
My grandmother gave me the choice of joining a sorority or taking a European trip after my studies, and I chose the European trip.
Paris, to be precise. The journey across the Atlantic took 10 days by ship, and Betty went with a friend.
Coming to Europe was the proper thing to do. A proper European trip was fine. You know, we had a place to stay in Paris. We were supposed to be studying a course at the Sorbonne.
But the studying part didn't last very long. Betty and a friend strapped on their backpacks and headed first to Morocco and then
almost to the Arctic Circle, over to Berlin and up to Denmark and up to Sweden and Norway.
And then in the autumn, she and another young woman decided to go to the Middle East.
We started out in Switzerland over a mountain pass, and then we went through Italy to Trieste and down through Yugoslavia, Greece, and over to Turkey. And this was in almost the middle of winter because we wanted to be in Bethlehem for Christmas.
And to get there, they stuck out their thumbs all through Syria.
That was very unusual. Two women hitchhiking down through an Arab country was very unusual. I think people were so stunned, they didn't know what kind of animal this was. So girls in pants. And,
now, at some point, Betty's not sure when, her passport from that adventure was lost. And that's where our second story begins. Last year, May 2011.
My name is Nuno Fonseca. I'm a med student. I'm from Portugal.
Nuno spent the previous year studying medicine in Paris.
The school year was just ending, and I wanted to take something from Paris that would remind me of the good time I spent there.
So he headed to a flea market to look around, but he wasn't having any luck.
When I was just about to leave and get to the last vendors, I found this passport, this old passport. It was full of visas from the first page to the last one.
And the name inside, Elizabeth Hatfield. She was around the same age as Nuno at the time it was issued. And then there was the address inside.
But finally, when I looked at the address and I saw that she lived in the same student housing complex where I used to live.
It was the student dorm Betty stayed at when she arrived to Paris in 1949, and it still houses students to this day. So Nuno Fonseca decided he had to track her down, and the first thing he did was to check Facebook.
Just to look for Elizabeth Hatfield.
No luck, so he went to Google.
There was an Elizabeth Hatfield who graduated from Berkeley University in 49.
And it also mentioned she was from a place called Ardsley Village in New York. So Nuno sent an email to the Ardsley Village manager.
He forwarded the email to the Historical Society, and through the connections they have established, they found their old high school mate, Betty, and she had an address in Paris, and that was my main lead.
And a few days later, Nuno got a phone number and a name. Elizabeth Hatfield was now Betty Werther.
I was very nervous. I didn't know if I was going to find a person. I didn't know in which language I should be addressing, French or English. And I didn't know if I did find this person, how would she react, if she would be interested or not at all.
I thought it was like a crank call. I'm used to having people phone me for money or to belong to something or to sign a petition. And so I almost hung up.
She was very surprised and she asked me, how is it possible that it ended in a flea market? But I had no answer to give whatsoever.
By that point, Nuno was already back in Portugal. But a few weeks ago, he decided he'd return to Paris to deliver the passport directly to Betty, 60 years after it went missing.
There was such a buildup to this that I was, you know, kind of palpitating. And when the doorbell rang...
It was fantastic. Betty is a very welcoming person, and she has lived a remarkable life, and she has many stories to tell.
The experience was to meet this person who'd gone to so much trouble. That was more important than the passport. It's the whole experience, which is extraordinary.
If I got a chance to find the person, for sure it would be someone amazing, and it would be rewarding. And it was indeed.
Nuno Fonseca, he's a med student in Portugal who found Betty Werther's lost passport at a Paris flea market 60 years after it went missing. The story came to us by way of UC Berkeley's News Center. To see photos of the passport and of Nuno and Betty's first meeting, head to npr.org. Time now for music. This is the number one song in America right now. It's called We Are Young, and it's by a pop rock trio called Fun, and that's Fun with a period at the end of it. And over the last few months, the band has blown up, period. The new record is called Some Nights, and at times, it sounds like it was co-written by a consortium that includes Andrew Lloyd Webber, Freddie Mercury, the rapper Drake, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And not too long ago, not a whole lot of people had heard of Fun, and even fewer people thought they'd ever make it big, but they have. Nate Roos is the lead singer for Fun, and Nate joins us now from KUT in Austin. Nate, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, congratulations on the top spot, man.
It's pretty surreal. Thank you. It's weird. It was never really our intention. I had signed to a major label when I was 19 years old, I kind of gave up then when I was dropped on the next album.
That was more than
11 years later.
11 years later. You've been in the game, as they say, for a long time. I was listening to Hot 99.5 here in Washington, D.C. last night. This song is on Super Size heavy rotation right now. Tell me the story of how this song got made.
I remember I had just started, I began the writing process for the album, and I was driving in a car, and the chorus just popped into my head. Because that's how I write music, is I don't play an instrument, I hear the songs in my head. And I thought, like, oh, this will be nice for, like, the end of a song, like, on an album. And as the days passed, the chorus just kept, like, getting stuck in my head. At the time, we were trying to get a hold of Jeff Basker, the producer who had done the last two Kanye West albums.
And had done a Beyonce record, a huge producer.
Yeah, and someone that wouldn't generally, like, take a meeting with us, but he blew me off two times, and then he and I met in the Bowery Hotel.
I read that you were waiting for him. You got there early, and you were so nervous, you actually had to have a couple drinks at the bar.
I think I was a little lubed up at that point. So I was able to kind of shed my general self-demeaning layer and just talk to him about everything. And we had a really great conversation. And he was working on the Beyonce stuff, so he was like, why don't you come up to my room and check out a demo for the Beyonce song I'm doing? And I was just so inspired in the moment that I just decided to sing that chorus.
To sing the chorus of the song We Are Young.
Yeah,
in
sing the chorus.
In his hotel room at the Bowery Hotel.
Yeah. And the other two guys in the band hadn't even heard the song yet. And I sang it to him. His jaw just, like, dropped. Like, we had to go to the studio either the next day or the day after that.
It's amazing.
It was incredible.
You sang in the chorus, no guitars, no nothing, just a cappella. You sang it for him, and he was like, this is going to be huge.
Yeah, it was amazing, the foresight that he had. And it went from, oh, this guy just wants to produce this song, to next thing I knew, he wanted to do the whole entire album.
I'll carry you home tonight.
It was so surreal for me. Just one of those daydreams where you like think about just the utmost like goal that you think will never happen, and this whole entire year has just been that.
I'm speaking with Nate Roos. He's the lead singer for the band Fun. Their single, We Are Young, is now the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. That song ended up kind of setting the tone for the record that you guys released 2 weeks ago.
There are some nights I hope.
Which is called Some Nights. That sort of, was that sort of the building block for this record?
It was. It was. I knew that we wanted to make the songs like add that element that Jeff brings to the table. And so after hearing We Are Young and the fact that it did work, I only had a month to finish really writing the gist of the entire album. And it was awesome because I felt like it was catching lightning in a bottle.
So I've been listening to your record these past few weeks, popped in my earbuds, and it starts actually like this.
'Cause there are some nights I hold you close, pushing you to hold me, oh, begging you to lock me up, never let me see the world.
So Nate, I'm hearing like Freddie Mercury and Jesus Christ Superstar right at the top of this record. I've read you describe it as theatrical music. I mean, literally, this album, parts of this album sound like you should be watching people on stage.
Thank you. It's very flattering, and I don't know where that really came from. Obviously, we're massive Queen fans, but it feels so much more inherent. I think a lot of it has to do with, like I said, writing songs in my head. Because of that, it's not on like this grid. It's with the lyrics. I'm writing the lyrics and the song. So I'm then presenting it to the other two guys in the band, and they do such a wonderful job of feeling where I'm at and feeling the tempo. And a lot of it is live, so it does move up and down, and it makes it very theatrical.
Some nights I stay up, cashing in my bad luck. Some nights I call it a draw.
Rolling Stone magazine called your sound a classic bubble pop tunefulness with Rococo rock and roll. I'm not sure what that means, but I think it's good. But they called your voice huge, all snarl, and Broadway panache.
What do I stand for? What do I stand for? Most nights I don't know anymore.
Nate, I love this music. You are so talented. This is such... I mean, there's an amazing wall of sound and melody in what you're recording. By the way, that what we just heard, that's you just on different tracks, right?
Yeah, that's a whole bunch of me. There's a gospel singer somewhere in there.
Tell me about yourself, Nate. I mean, you've been in this business a long time. You were in bands before. We're not in New York. This has been a long road.
Yeah, it's been a crazy, crazy long road, and as soon as my last band had broken up, I spent many nights just, like, sleepless and wondering whether I had some, like, major personality flaws, why maybe someone wouldn't want to be in a band with me anymore, and I thought, all right, well, maybe I should kind of just give it up.
You sing about it.
10 years of this, I'm not sure if anybody understands.
10 years of this, I'm not sure if anybody understands.
Yeah, it's. I do just. I worry about how much older I'm getting and what my threshold is. And I'm learning a lot right now just based on all this new success that we've had. I used to think I knew everything, and really now I know nothing, and I'm excited to know nothing.
You've said that even before this record became a huge hit and We Are Young became the number one song in the country as it is now, that you found this record to be the most rewarding thing you have done in your career.
Without a doubt.
What makes you proudest of this album?
I think the content, I think lyrically, just maturing into something and not being as close-minded, I think, as I have been just about music in general and being more willing to try things, and Jeff Basker, the producer, played such a huge part in that because he brought something that none of us knew anything about and made us feel like children again.
That's Nate Roos. He's the frontman for the band Fun. Their new album is called Some Nights, and their single We Are Young is currently the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100. Nate, congratulations and thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And it's time now for music.
What are you listening to?
The Shins. You know them?
No.
You gotta hear this one song. It'll change your life, I swear.
Not everyone can say Natalie Portman changed their life, but James Mercer can. That clip from the 2004 film Garden State started the buzz about Mercer's band, The Shins. Since then, they've become one of the biggest bands in indie rock. James Mercer took a break 5 years ago to work on other projects and to start a family. In fact, he's had two children since he last released a Shins record. Well, that drought ends on Tuesday when the Shins release their eagerly awaited Port of Morrow. This new version of the Shins bears almost no resemblance to the old Shins. Mercer is the only original member left, and lyrically, the band is taking on much weightier topics.
I was thinking about religious violence.
Huh.
And what it must be like to be in a situation where it seems that your fate has brought you to battle.
Like it's been determined for you.
Right. So long before you were born.
A song like this one, Rifle Spiral, makes sense when you learn more about James Mercer's upbringing. He grew up as an Air Force brat, moving from Hawaii to England to Germany and eventually New Mexico, following a father with a very sensitive job.
He was in charge of the Inter-Service Nuclear Weapons School. You would go there, any member of NATO who needed to know how to handle nuclear weapons...
Went to him.
Would go to that school. Yeah, and he was like the principal.
But you grew up traveling every couple years, moving every few years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, born in Hawaii and then moved all over after that.
I mean, did that sort of create this sense of constant change, a need for constant change? I'm getting to somewhere with this, which is the band. I mean, you have new members in the band and you've been working with new artists every couple of years, and it seems like this trajectory you've been on has been one of constant change.
Yes, I see what you're saying. possibly. I do know that there's something refreshing to me about working with different people, and it probably is because I'm accustomed to that. I'll have to go to a therapist maybe to figure this all out.
Yeah, maybe this is a little bit too probing. The title track on this record, Port of Morrow, that's a place, right?
Yeah, it is a sort of a innocuous place along the Columbia River. I think it's an industrial port.
Why are you singing about it?
Well, when we would return from tour, you know, we would pass this sign that said Port of Morrow that way. And I just, it's so evocative. And I had it written down in my notebook. And I just thought the Port of Morrow, it sounded like maybe the place you go to finally depart, you know, like maybe on the River Styx. So I ended up using that line in a list of dark, ominous things. It was Jimmy Swaggart, actually, that I had seen on a TV show, and he was preaching about how even little children are going to be sent to hell if you don't get them to do whatever. You know, I don't want to cuss on the thing, but I got my ire up about this Jimmy Swaggart guy, and so in the song I say a preacher on the stage like a buzzard cries out this warning of phony sorrow. So that's where it came from. It just became in my mind this this mysterious, dark thing.
I'm speaking with James Mercer of the band The Shins. Their new record comes out on Tuesday. It's called Port of Morrow. I want to ask you about a song on this record. It's called September. September.
a shining face in a million reflections of tiny raindrops that fall in a veil over our city like notes from above. And it overwhelms me, it just ain't that tough. It's not that the darkness can't touch our lives, I know it will in time. But she's no ordinary Valentine.
I understand if this is a love song to your wife, and there's a lyric in that song. It's not that the darkness can't touch our lives, I know it will in time.
Yes, I know what you're getting at. I think that one of the things about having children is that you are really exposed to how fragile they are, and you see them changing so quickly. It's almost like stop motion photography. Especially with me going away for a few weeks at a time and then coming back, and suddenly they're, oh my gosh, you know, she's using sentences now, and you can't help but see that. This change, you sort of mourn the loss of the infant. There's this sense that all of this beauty is developing and changing and in certain ways slipping away. That darkness is, you know, I guess the eventual thing. I mean, the darkness finds you. It will. All of us, you know. And I guess you might ask, why would you remind somebody of that in a love song? But I feel like there's something beautiful about recognizing that.
Yeah.
That things are all transient and all the more beautiful for it.
Under our softly burning lamp, she takes her time telling stories of our possible lives, and love is the ink in the well when her body writes. I've been selfish and full of pride, and she knows deep down there's a little child. But I got a good side to me as well, and it's that she loves in spite of everything else.
You mentioned the kids, and you've got a four-year-old and a two-year-old, right?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you have been busy since the last Shins record came out.
Right.
How does it change your approach to being a musician, or does it at all?
I don't like being away from the house as much. Yeah. I mean, I like to be home, and touring, therefore, is kind of a pain. But on the other side, I mean, I think it has added that new dimension to my perspective on the world, even. I'm more sensitive to what's going on in other countries because I know that when they say, you know, children were hurt in this bombing or whatnot, it's just, you know, you just feel it viscerally, you know. So that I think, has maybe made my lyrics a little bit more elaborate about those sorts of issues.
Up beyond the western squalls in an alien land, they work for nothing at all, they don't know them all, or the layaway plan. Dig yourself a beautiful grave, everything you could want. Maybe those invisible slaves are too far away for a ghost to haunt. What do we charge? Letting go of a claim so.
Now you're going to tour this record, and it's already getting a lot of great critical acclaim. I mean, how do you feel? Do you sort of just throw everything you got into this thing for the next 5 or 6 months and then take a break?
Yeah, it'll be a year, probably, of working pretty hard touring for this. And that is how my wife and I are looking at it. You know, we just feel like we've you know, we've worked this hard to get this record right. It'll be hard for the next year, but let's do it. And we kind of just take each project with that idea in mind. You know, that we're lucky to have a lifestyle like this. When I'm home, I'm home. I'm not, you know, 9 to 5 in an office, so I get to spend a lot of time with the kids when I'm there. And we just try and make those moments count.
That's James Mercer. He fronts the band The Shins. Their new record comes out on Tuesday. It's called Port of Morrow. James Mercer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the record.
Ah, thanks.
Ending March 18th, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs on Saturday and Sunday. This week, the show was directed by Petra Mayer. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, and Megan Kane. Lauren Beneshu is our intern. Our editor is Mathoni Maturi. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. And thanks for tuning in.
Psychic derailer, drive this car to the sea, spend the night as high as I can in a towering hemlock, but it's no use, it can always be found.